You see, ladies and gentlemen, that I have responsibilities. If people honor me and they invite me to help with projects, I only feel greater responsibilities, which sometimes lead me to the hospital. I just came out of one. I'm going to speak to you tonight about how to build the cities of tomorrow. First, let me explain why I speak of the cities of tomorrow, because we cannot do anything for the cities of today. It is too late. The cities of tomorrow are going to be here, though. Our city, Lansing, is going to be here tomorrow. And if we start thinking tonight, we may do something for the city of Lansing tomorrow by conceiving new ideas in the proper way. We may convince others in a year or two. We may have approvals in 3 or 4 years. We may have execution starting in 5 years and see our first projects, city-wide projects, having an impact in 10 years. So you see why it is wrong to speak about action for the cities of today. In any case, we act for the cities of tomorrow. Now I want to present to you 3 points. The first, they are all contained in the title. The first point is what is going to be tomorrow. The second is what kind of cities we expect tomorrow, and then how to build them. I'll start with tomorrow. What is tomorrow? We make a very grave mistake in thinking always that tomorrow is like today, but it's not going to be. We live in the era of the greatest human revolution in all fields, a revolution which in terms of dimension and dimensions is moving always upwards. We will deal with more people, with greater areas, with larger projects. A revolution which in terms of quality is moving sometimes upwards, like in telecommunications, in the production and distribution of energy, and sometimes, or very often, downwards, especially when we think of human values, of human scale, of real services to man. So tomorrow is something which we'll have to understand. Some people say we shape tomorrow. In some way we do, in other ways we don't. For example, science is gradually convinced that it is very difficult to interfere with the very broad trends of the evolution of population, through population control, for example. It's not so easy. The best experts, like Dr. René Dubos, are convinced in their last announcements that this is not an easy and perhaps it's not a wise act. The population of the Earth increases. By the end of the century, we are going to have about 7 billion people. That's double the population which we have, almost double the present population. It's quite characteristic that the official estimates are beginning to speak now about such a population, where 10 years ago they were speaking of 5 billion people for the year 2000. 5 years ago they were speaking of 6 billion people, and now they are beginning to speak of 6.5 and 7 billion people. I mention this to show how difficult it is for ourselves to be reconciled with the idea that great changes take place. So we are going to deal with a population double the present size, which may entitle somebody to say, all right, we are going to have double problems, and he will be wrong. Because where the population of the Earth is going to reach from 3.3 the 7 billion mark, the urban population, which is now almost 1 billion, is going to be close to 4.5 or 5 billion, which means that in the urban areas with which we are mainly dealing and about which we are talking, we are going to have five times more the people. Now, as the few people of my generation who sit in this room do not alter very much the average age of this audience, I'm entitled to say that by the end of this century, at the time at which the generation graduating the next few years from this university will be in charge, so that we are speaking about something which is very close to us, by that time we'll have to deal with five times more people in our cities. And this is not all. As the incomes are increasing everywhere, and as by the end of the century, it is very probable that we are going to have four times the income per capita which we have today. If we multiply, we'll see what this means. Five times more people with a total income in the urban areas of the order of 20 times larger than at present. We have not thought about this seriously, and this is why we very often make grave mistakes. You'll ask me whether I believe that these people are going to be equally spread in all cities. No, there are cities which are going to have much more and others much less. But the whole system of cities is going to have 20 times more pressures than it has today, just in a generation's time. Now, these are some of the dimensions of the future. But let us look now at other problems of the future, because I said that not all the curves into the future move upwards. Whilst the technology improves, energy is produced more and more, and for the first time we can communicate with everybody on any part of the earth by the telecommunication satellites, we are losing the battles near the human scale, near man. We cannot allow our children to run in the streets. We cannot go out for a walk. A very beautiful cartoon, I saw it in several American newspapers just in the last 2 days, it seems it's one of the syndicated ones, presents two young people in a very ugly neighborhood, and the one is asking the other, "I wonder why my mother insists that I get out to get fresh air. There is no fresh air in many parts of our cities, especially in the parts where we have air conditioned and air purification plants in our buildings. We take the contaminated air out to breathe it when we go to get some fresh air. We are completely unreasonable in our behavior when we deal with man. We are not free to walk, we are not free to run in our cities. We are losing the battle, and for the first time in human history, we introduced the red lights in the streets. I think this is the greatest step backwards in human history, because for the first time we tell man that he's not free to move in the cities. All this shows that the future which we are creating is not always as good as the past. It is sometimes better. It is always larger. It is very often worse. Now, if this is the first idea we get about the future, let us see for a moment what happens to our cities. Our cities started, I don't know which one of these devices helps you more. Would you tell me, please, if I try to draw here?
There's no wrong.
I see. How can I use
this one?
Now, if we could look the surface of the earth from the air,
several thousands of years back. We could see perhaps that the whole earth was covered by such small spots, every one representing one family with one compound wall to protect it from the wild animals all around, inhabited small spots inhabited by nomads moving around. Then came the era during which people of these spots came together and they built villages. Now we are dealing in this era with larger spots on the earth. And then about 6,000 years ago came the era when many of these people from the villages built larger areas. And these were the cities. And they introduced a system of roads connecting them with the villages and with the farms. Now we have passed beyond this era, because if this was the average city of the past, now we have seen it growing because of the first railway into several more cities, and the central city has grown. Then we have seen this city growing even more by the highways which have been brought in, growing along the highways, connected with the villages of the surrounding, which are turned into urban centers, into satellites, and gradually this small city of the past, which was here, has covered an area much larger than this whole area. If you think, for example, that Athens of the classical era is only 1/15 of Athens of the present in area. It had 50,000 inhabitants when Pericles was creating the golden era. It has 2.5 million people now. And it is growing at such a rate that by the end of the century, will be happy if it will not exceed the 4.5 million mark. It's quite probable that it will be move beyond 5 million people. So you see that what we used to call city does not exist. It does not exist anymore in two senses. The one sense is in size of population. We had few people, and now we have many. The other sense was related to its dynamism. It was a static city in the past, surrounded by walls, and it became a dynamic city today. Athens grows by 18 dwellings every hour. It grows by 2,000 square feet of streets every hour. The static city of the past has become now a dynamic city. This is why we must understand that the harmony, the balance which the ancient Greeks tried to create between man and city, city and landscape, city and nature, is not possible anymore. The Aristotelian, Platonian ideal of a static city, both described utopias of 50 to 60,000 people, is not anymore possible. We are moving much more towards conceptions which are dynamic ones, which go back to another principle declared before Aristotle and Plato by another Greek philosopher, by Heraclitus, who says that everything changes. We move towards such cities, we live in such cities, and this is our very great problem. The cause of our problems, and which creates a great dilemma for us, because we are building cities
which are static in many respects. The walls we built here are static. They correspond, and they could correspond to an ideal of harmony. But people inside move, and the people inside don't simply move, they spread afterwards into several directions, and next year they will build a city of Lansing which will be much larger and different from the city of Lansing of today. And this is one of our grave problems, this great antithesis between the necessity to build human shells, which are permanent, which are static. We cannot let them grow and again become smaller at night. They will have to remain in these places. And to build cities consisting of static elements, but cities which grow, which cannot remain static. You'll ask perhaps, but the buildings can remain static. Yes, the buildings can remain static. But how about traffic and functions? Because if a city is small and it has this width of streets here, which corresponds to 50,000 people and a certain number of cars, when the city grows and becomes much larger, it does not need only new design, new plans for the red areas. Can you see the color, the different color? But because this city relies on the old nucleus, it brings red traffic into the black network. And where the buildings could remain static, the roads cannot be static and serve in the same way. Where we had only 200 cars an hour, we may now have 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 20,000. And here we have the contrast, the antithesis between the shells that we are building, which are permanent, static in relation to man's movements, and the functions which we create, which are changing continuously. These are the cities of today, the dynamic cities, which we did not understand properly, and this is why we failed everywhere in the world to face their problems, and these are going to be the cities of tomorrow, even more so, because it is very unreasonable for us to believe that because we have a city, and now look across it, and I present here the densities of functions, the highest densities in the middle, the lowest densities on the sides. It is unreasonable for us to believe that we can let the city grow in the next phase, and we'll have pressures exercised only in the new areas. By necessity, the pyramid is going to grow also in the middle, and it is going to create pressures going beyond the point which was allowed by the structure of the central city. And therefore, we come to the conclusion that it is impossible for us to build cities in the old way and expect them to operate satisfactorily in the future. We have to reverse our thinking. We have to start thinking in different ways. Now I will just illustrate one or two such ways. If we have one city here which grows by concentric circles, as most of our cities do, we have such big pressures in the center that the center is choked to death. It cannot operate anymore. By necessity, we have to devise another system and see whether
this city could be saved from being besieged by growth, which increases the pressures, whether it could not do exactly what a besieged army does, break through in one direction and grow in one direction. In which case, the central area will grow in one direction, following the growth of the city, or vice versa, and the pressures on the old city are going to remain as small as they were. Pressures in the new parts of the city are going to increase, but the new parts of the city will be built for higher pressures, because at the time at which we'll be building them, we'll know how big the pressures are going to be on them. In this way, we move from the idea of a city which we allow to grow by itself to a city which we guide for its growth. Now, the situation is not as simple as that always. Very often, we have much more complicated situations because our cities have already grown into each other. We have one city here and one city there and there. We have three cities and the system of their interconnections. And we know that these cities are growing in this way and are growing also gradually along the axis connecting them. Now, if we allow all these cities to grow, there is no hope for them. If, though, we have the ability to create a new center here, we may hope that the future growth, instead of being added around the cities, will be added around here and around this axis, which will be prepared, and therefore people coming from outside will be connected through this new center, and through this new center, which will take off all the new pressures, they will move to the old centers. And in this way, sometimes I'm told, all right, you solve the problem of new center of new people. No, I'm not solving their problem. I'm solving also the problem of the old people and the old centers. Because the only way to save the old centers and the inhabitants of the old cities is to take off the new pressures for the which they are not prepared off their shoulders. And this is the only possibility which will lead to a reasonable, to a rational solution. Now, this is sometimes easy for man to understand in some situations. In other situations, it is not easy because the situations are complicated. But if we begin thinking not to follow all trends, but to reverse some trends, if we are beginning to be realistic that we cannot reverse the desire of humanity to industrialize, to increase productivity, to be more educated, to have better health services, to live in big centers which provide all these services to people. If we are going to be realistic about these facts, and we are going to see that our real challenge is not to change the natural trends, but to guide the natural trends for a better city, then we are going to understand that we can act, and if we understand this through proper analysis of the situations, we can certainly lead to much more satisfactory solutions for the cities of the present, which have to retain their values. Economic buildings should not be turned into slums before they are completely economically amortized. Cultural, why should we abandon the beautiful neighborhoods of the past? Either beautiful for the whole nation, like Williamsburg, for example, or for the people who have built them, because the beauty is very subjective. And if some people like an old neighborhood, why should we deprive them of the pleasure of
seeing their neighborhood survive. I was dealing lately, last year and this year, with a very complicated problem, a small area of New York called Williamsburg, again in Brooklyn. It is inhabited by old Jewish sects. Now, several people wanted to demolish this area, and a part has already been demolished, and they called it an area corresponding to the era of the past. But when I saw the inhabitants and I talked to them, I was convinced that this area represented great values for these inhabitants. So even if the others did not like the area, why should not we find ways to preserve this small unit, whatever it is, within a growing organism, by allowing such units to remain static, to keep their values? And we don't know, maybe the next generation is going to consider these neighborhoods much more important for culture than the ones we are creating today. We don't have the right to demolish until a project, an area, a neighborhood, a city has been amortized from every point of view, economic, social, and cultural. This is the type of problems we are going to have in our cities. With this, I think I'll turn to the most difficult question of all, to my third question, of building the cities of tomorrow. How can we build these cities? Here, our obligation increases enormously. It increases enormously because we may fall into one of two traps: the traps of conservatism and the traps of progressiveness, if both are misunderstood. Personally, I believe that we must be extremely conservatives and extremely revolutionaries. But to find where we need every such policy. For example, when I deal with anything related to man and close to man, I learned that I must be extremely conservative. I am against the round rooms. I'm against the ceilings, and I'm not speaking of the special rooms, which are not even. I'm against depriving man of his ability and desire to walk, because it is by walking, anthropology told us, when he jumped from the trees, that he developed his present form. I don't know what is going to happen when we are going to deprive him of this desire and ability and necessity. He started developing his eyes only because he came down from the trees. Before that phase, he was relying much more on his nose and his ears. If we are going to turn him into a new, modern center, half man and half car, if we are not going to allow him to walk, do we know what is going to happen to his system? He will start suffering in his heart and his whole cardiovascular system, in his peptic system, maybe gradually in his brain, in his mind, because he is going to identify himself more and more with the car, more and more with the machine and the power of the machine. I don't say that I know these things. I only say that because I don't know them, and nobody can guarantee to us anything, I am extremely conservative in dealing with the units closer to man. But if I go to the other end, if I speak of traffic in the city, if I speak of large units, then I have to be completely revolutionary, because the system of roads which we are still building today is ridiculous. We have cars which all of us buy, they are produced out here, next door to you, which can run at 100 miles an hour, and we allow them to cross our cities at an average of 9 miles an hour. Is this reasonable? If you ask any mechanical engineer to create for you in a factory a movement for goods on two conveyors, and he designs the conveyors at the same level, you are going to throw him out. But we do design our roads in two directions at the same level, and we are not throwing ourselves out. We introduce red lights. So we build powerful engines, and then we stop the cars every few minutes. It's completely unreasonable. I know that the answer is to these statements, but would it not be more expensive? To this, allow me to answer that bringing the roads at different levels is not the only answer to our problem. We'll see later another answer, and we have not tried them for our normal residential area, so we don't know yet how much it will cost. On main avenues, we begin to know exactly that to build roads on the surface of the streets is tending to be equally expensive. Roads on the surface of the city, on the earth, is equally expensive with tunnels. Actually, a recent study prepared by the Rand Corporation has proved that where the cost of road building moves in this way in the future, here is about 1970 and 1980, the cost of construction of tunnels goes down in this way. And it is expected that in the middle 70s it will be cheaper to construct tunnels than to construct highways, which shows that we must be prepared already for the cities of tomorrow to construct deep ways and not highways, and to change our attitude, because in these deep ways people should not be afraid they will spend their time there and their life. We can develop speeds of 200 miles easily. Present-day cars can run at 100 miles, but 10 to 15 years from now, we can develop speeds of 200 miles, and thus you understand how little time we'll need to spend, which revolutionizes our conception of the city and changes our attitude to many of these problems. So you see why now I allow myself to say that our attitude should change, because it is there that our problems are always, and that if we try to present the whole earth in this scale, in a logarithmic scale, from the smallest unit of man, one, the second unit, room, the third unit, house, a big building, neighborhood, and so on, up to the largest unit, it may interest you, it is of the order of 15 in a relation to the one man, it is a logarithmic, we call it a kistic logarithmic scale, and if we place here 0 and 100%, our attitude in the city should be represented in this way. We should be very conservative in the small units and not conservative at all in the big ones, because it is in the small units that man has experimented for thousands of years, and what you see as a room is the result of thousands of years of efforts of man, who started building this type of rooms, and then elliptical ones, and then this type, and then he gradually was led to the rectilinear ones, and from the
spherical covering, he understood gradually that he cannot put one semisphere on the other, and he has built, by using rectilinear types of construction, in every direction. This he has learned by trial and error, and it took him thousands of years. There we have to be conservative. On the other hand, dealing with new forces, with machines, with distances which man was not used, we have to be very revolutionary, leading towards larger units. Now, if we start thinking in this way, we'll see how we can face some of our problems. To face these problems more systematically, we have to go back to the essentials. We build cities. Why? Aristotle says, and it's still the best definition I know, to make man happy and safe. So we build cities for human happiness and for human safety. Man, who is man? Some people measure him, measure his body, and we have the famous drawing of Da Vinci presenting man this way. A drawing which has influenced modern architecture enormously. I remind you of the measurements, for example, presented in Neufert's book, who derives everything from the human measurements, or Corbusier's modular, again derived from the human body. But if we think that the human body represents man, we are completely wrong, because man consists of at least four aspects on which we can put our finger: his body, his senses, his mind, and his soul. And we have to see man as an entity in order to understand that we may say that this small Da Vincian man may need this space, but this is only the space of his body. We cannot build a room on the basis of these measurements. The room needs a much greater space if we place this man now here looking at his wall. We cannot place the wall in front of him. We have to place the wall at such a distance that we allow him to have the proper distance for his senses, not for his body. So it is another aspect of man which enters the picture. And if this man suffers in his mind, if this man wants to relax, he may have to open this door and go out into the open, because even the wall looks to him like the wall of a prison. And this may be a problem of his mind or a problem of his soul. In this way, we begin to think that this Da Vincian man is only one presentation of a much more complex phenomenon whose smelling reaches to another sphere. I'm representing again all this in a logarithmic scale, whose hearing goes beyond this, whose sight goes beyond, whose mind goes beyond. He can now, with his mind, understand what happens in the cosmos, and whose soul, perhaps, goes beyond this, as we know this also from science, that soul must precede what the mind conceives. It is this desire of the soul to go beyond that opens the new horizons. So you see that we are dealing with a small animal, but which is the center of many concentric spheres with which we have to deal. Now, these are the spheres
which should be our concern. How?
Here, the situation becomes more difficult. Because here we have such experts on man, like Alexis Carrel, who a generation ago, when I was sitting in your place, has drawn our attention to the fact that man is the great unknown. And for those of you who have not read his famous book, it's not so fashionable as it was in my generation when it came out. I strongly recommend it. Man, the great unknown, still creates for us problems because we are working for him. But this same man has created a very big laboratory which we have inherited, the laboratory on the surface of the earth. This man who has built cities, villages, houses, monuments for thousands of years, being the same man, research director and guinea pig, and trying all the methods in what is a proper scientific method, by trial and error, by elimination of the weakest solutions. This man has acquired an experience, and this experience we have to acquire from him by very carefully studying what happens. Here is Dr. Boyland, where I come back to my statement that acoustics cannot be an art or a technology. It has to be a science, because it has to learn in a scientific way. Now, what is the scientific way? As Bronowski, who is now one of the most important physicists and who is now the co-director of the Salk Institute in California, has defined science in an excellent way as consisting of facts and ideas. Facts and ideas. We pay too much attention in architecture. One addition to your introduction, sir. I got my first degree in architecture and then in engineering. So I call myself an architect. We pay too much attention to ideas. But the ideas are not important unless they follow well-established facts. Now, the facts are here. The facts about man's action up to now, about man's body, senses, mind, and soul. And these facts we must control completely before developing new ideas. This is what we try to do. We try to understand these animals in space, how they move, how they bring together with them some bubbles which an American anthropologist, Dr. Nate Hall of Chicago, calls the human bubbles, because he rightly says that if this is man and this is another man, they cannot talk to each other by sitting so closely. They have to have their human bubbles in contact. If these human bubbles are too far, these people cannot talk to each other. You know that from your personal experience. If these people are following one speaker here, their bubbles become elongated. Now you can't stand sitting so close to each other because you all look in this direction. But if you had to change directions by 90 degrees, you would have to step out in a few minutes. You could not stand the situation. This animal is oriented like a magnet. It can find itself in balance in some directions, in not in balance in other directions. We have to start understanding this small unit, this small animal for which we are working. If we do so, will gradually find ways in which we can achieve a much better synthesis between the animals, between the steel bubbles around them, the cars, or the much greater bubbles, shells that we build, the houses, and will be led to the point of thinking, how can we now conceive the city of the future? I have been speaking throughout this presentation about two things. I have been speaking on the one hand about man, conservatism, small units around him, the lessons of the past and our experience, and on the other hand I have been speaking about nature, the whole earth, technology, dynamic changes, expanding cities. I have been speaking about Aristotelian static small conceptions, and I have been speaking about Heraclitian conceptions of change in a very large scale. Let us go back to our first notion, tomorrow. Tomorrow is going to be a dynamic one. Humanity is going to witness growth to the order of 10, 20, 30 billion people. By then, the experts in schools like this one, where we are now the guests of natural resources, tell us by then that we are going to witness a slowing down of the population of the earth, which increases because we may be reaching a ceiling here and we may follow the logarithmic curve. But it is certain, on the basis of all our measurements, that this level cannot be below the 15 billion mark. And it is going probably to go as high as 50 billion. But even with 15 billion mark, by the middle of the next century, when some of you and the greatest percentage of your children is going to be alive, even with these 15 billion people, we'll have 13 billion urban dwellers, which means 30 times more than the present urban population. This is a fact. We have to reckon with this fact. So change and unbelievably large dimensions. We have to reckon with it. This is a fact. We cannot say we want a utopian world. It does not help. On the other hand, we have the necessity to create static small units. In the same way in which our clothing is static, our rooms, our houses have to be static, because otherwise we would turn crazy if the walls would move with every minute outside, as the boundaries of the cities do. We need small units, and we need them as peaceful as possible, because the pediatrists and the psychologists and the anthropologists are convinced we must give to the expecting mother and to the child at the beginning of its life as stable a surrounding, as quiet as possible. We cannot expect our children to grow into happy, steady people unless they are given all of the chances to have a quiet house, a quiet garden, then to be able quietly to discover the world by visiting the neighborhood by themselves without being afraid of cars, and then gradually growing into the community and into the society, which is dynamic. The educators have warned us about that. The psychologists are certain, the anthropologists are certain. So in a world of growth and change, we need areas which, for many of the reasons we mentioned, must be static and balanced. And this is our great problem, how to reconcile the two. I think at this moment we'll abandon the other sciences and we'll turn to biology. And we'll remember that nature, which started over a billion years ago by bringing chemicals to form the first cells, what Huxley calls the biological individuals of first order, has then led to biological individuals of second order, not by allowing the cell to grow. This happens only in very exceptional cases, but by building many cells together into systems, by allowing the one cell to divide into similar ones with the initial one. This is the way nature has solved this problem. The necessity of a static, stable surrounding for the creation of life, which takes place in the cell, and a dynamically growing and changing organism. I think we have here to repeat this experience. And we have to understand that we must find the unit of cells in the human settlements, and then see how these units can be interconnected into a growing system. Again, we'll repeat that from nature, by allowing special arteries to come into them, to feed them, to take away from the cells what has to be thrown out. And thus we can build a system in our cities which will consist of cells and networks. You'll say, all right on paper, but how about these cells? What are these cells? Now, strangely enough, these cells have not to be discovered. They exist. And the human laboratory has created them for 6,000 years. These are the so-called cities of the past. Cities which have reached the 18th century, but have not gone beyond. Cities which have the following characteristics on all continents. They are small, they are static, and they are surrounded by a skin, the walls. You remember my first sketch. This, if we study them, have some common characteristics. They have not more than 50,000 people. They have no more than 2,000 yards across. It may interest you that until the 17th century, we had only three cities which went way beyond this mark, the capitals of the three empires, of the Byzantine, of the Roman, and of the Mongol Empire. That's Constantinople, Rome, and Peking. But all three cities, which became too big,
have not survived. They had to go back to the small size in order to survive. They could keep the big size only for a certain period. It may interest you that the 2,000 yards is exactly the distance from the center of 1,000 yards or 10 minutes walk, which is the preferable distance still in our cities for walking. So we have the cells. We are simply in the era in which, exactly as it happened in nature over a billion years ago, these cells, which in nature were in big distances at the beginning, are converging to form organisms. Primitive first and developed later. And here we come to a point which has been bothering me for years, which I think I finally answered, at least to my own satisfaction, and this is something, you know, to satisfy yourselves if something troubles you, that Huxley said that the world is full of three types of biological organisms, biological individuals. The ones of first order, the cells, the ones of second order, animals and plants, many cells, and the ones of third order, human societies. First, second, and third. I begin to believe that here we got confused, that the third order are not societies, but human settlements. Because society alone, without a human settlement, does not exist. If we take all the inhabitants of this campus, or of Detroit area, out in the desert of Texas, we let them in one night, they cannot operate. They operate here because the shell, the networks, help them to operate organically, to go to this seminar, to go to that dormitory, and to this cafeteria at certain hours, to function properly. So it is not the corresponding unit, it's not the human society, but it is the human settlement that is nature, man, society, the shells and the networks, exactly for the same reasons for which the snail consists of snail and shell, and the whole is the snail, and only when the snail inside exists is the whole operating, for the same reason for which man consists of body, senses, mind, and soul. So here we are at the point of recognizing that the cities of tomorrow are organisms and that we can't create them on the basis of these principles. If we reach this point, then it is beginning to be easier for us to understand that we will have to create rational networks for machines at high speeds, within which we will have human communities corresponding to the cells of the past, allowing for people to walk in all directions. So that no unit of these static ones, the blue ones, corresponding the human movement, is going to be hurt, because this organism grows more in the next generation. This will mean no new pressures on the small units. The schools can operate normally. The community can have a balance with itself, with its surrounding. No blight is necessary, which is due to pressures of an expanding center, because the new system, which is a mechanical one at high speeds, very revolutionary, corresponding to man's technology,
is going one thing, and the human scale consisting leading to cells of 20, 30, up to 50,000 people is the other unit. This is the way for us, I think, to answer this very difficult problem, how to reconcile the necessity for growth and change with the necessity of a static, balanced, harmonical surrounding for man. On this, we made several attempts which have led to the development of several systems which we try. By trying them, we suffer. As I mentioned some Greeks tonight, let me mention Aeschylus, who said that the only way to learn is by suffering. We try, we suffer, we face difficult problems, but gradually I think we are led to a body of experience that can be used by the others, by an experience which is not the artist's personal experience, which is not transmitted, but the scientist's common experience, which is transmitted by a scientific language. This is what we attempt to do. This is what I have learned in these years of involvement with human settlements, with cities of the present, of the past, and of tomorrow. And this is what I try to transmit to you tonight. Thank you.